Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. The big news at Cherry Bomb headquarters is that our latest issue is finally here. Thank goodness. Martha Stewart is our cover girl, and I got to interview Martha for the cover story, and I will confess, I'm always slightly nervous interviewing Martha, but she's so interesting and has done so much over the years that she always has great things to say, and this cover story is no exception. Also in this issue, we have a special section called She's the Boss that features lots of, well, boss ladies. And author Julia Tertian, who you all know and love, did a special story for us. She interviewed a dozen influential people in the food space to see how they are incorporating activism into their lives and work. The new Cherry Bomb is available for order at cherrybomb.com. Or you can find it next week at Barnes & Noble or your favorite indie bookstore. If you're coming to the Foodiaticals Market this weekend at the Food Book Fair in Manhattan, you can pick up a copy there. We'll be debuting it at Foodiaticals. Let's thank the sponsors of today's show. Everyone knows Kerrygold butter is the bomb. But did you know that Kerrygold also has a beautiful range of Irish cheese? They're not only delicious, but they're made with milk from grass-fed cows, so it's a product you can believe in. Pick up some of their aged cheddar, Blarney Castle cheese, or Dubliner cheese with Irish stout at a market near you. Also, Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from nine-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Or, how about one of their three-hour masterclasses on everything from baking the most delicious macaroons to making that perfect sauce? Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. You know, Dave, I know I mentioned this, but I'm going to be on vacation next week, and I'll be in London and Paris. And
yes, without me.
Without you.
I know.
And I'm hoping to take some classes, and if I successfully sign up for some, I will put it on my Instagram account. So if anybody happens to be in London and Paris next week, maybe we can take some classes together, which would be fun. Right, Dave?
Yeah, that would be the bomb.
Speaking of the bomb, our first guest is Andrea Nguyen, one of the most respected experts on Vietnamese cooking. Her newest book, The Pho Cookbook, celebrates her lifelong love of the aromatic comfort food, which she first tasted as a child in Saigon. Andrea, who was born in Vietnam and came to the United States at the age of six, has authored several books about Asian food, including Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, Asian Dumplings, and The Banh Mi Handbook. Andrea Nguyen, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks so much for having me today.
It's such an honor to have you on the show. I mean, Vietnamese cuisine is my absolute favorite, so I'm thrilled to have you here to pick your brain and to have you share some of your wisdom with our listeners.
Well, pick away, Carrie.
You know, I love the new book. I was reading the new book before the show, and you had so many interesting things in there. And one of the things I wrote down, you wrote, since the age of 10, when I gained a certain command of English, I've been reading and studying cookbooks. I perused cookbooks, both East and West, as if they were novels. I watched PBS shows by Julia Child and Martin Yan and observed their moves and took in their knowledge. I fantasized about doing something in food, but first-generation immigrants don't do that. What does that mean?
That means that when my family came to the U.S. in 1975, you know, we're first generation. We were refugees. We were fleeing for our lives. And so financial security was really important for us. And my parents would always say, okay, like the oldest child needs to be a pharmacist because we should own a pharmacy. And then my second sister became a doctor, a lawyer, you know, another pharmacist. And by the time they got to me, they sort of left me alone. And I was able to do what I wanted to do, but I still felt that that pressure of doing something that was practical and money making. And so I was in banking, and but at the same time, you know, I learned a lot about American culture and society by reading cookbooks, and I go to the library because we couldn't afford stuff, and we couldn't afford to buy like children's books at the book fairs. And so I wanted to write a cookbook, but I just didn't think that a first generation person who came here without knowing English, without, you know, knowing the system of publishing, could ever write cookbooks.
You seem like this wonderfully quirky little kid, 10 years old, reading cookbooks, watching Julia Child. I sort of have this image of you in my head.
Yes, you know.
What made you gravitate toward cookbooks at that age?
Well,
when other people were reading, I don't know, Bobbsey Twins, Nancy Drew,
things like that. Right, Beverly Cleary.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my, I'm going to date myself then.
Some early Judy Blume.
Yes, totally early Judy Blume. I love the ingredients and how they came together. And I would read the glossary of American cookbooks because, like, I had no idea what marjoram or rosemary, like, smelled like or tasted like. And I fantasized about it. I knew what Thai basil was like. And certain Vietnamese herbs, like rau rem, Vietnamese coriander. But I had no idea. These were things that were so exotic to me. And we couldn't afford them. And my mom had no reason to buy those herbs. But I wanted to learn more. And when my family came here to the U.S., we would go to the American grocery store, the supermarkets. And I'm just absolutely fascinated by supermarkets. And we would look at everything. And I was poking at all the packaged meats in the, you know, meat department, because I was like, wow, in Vietnam, you can like, nothing was ever covered in plastic and nothing was on styrofoam. But here I was just like poking at stuff and running out of the market, and my parents were really embarrassed.
Oh, let's talk about your childhood a little bit more. I mean, when your family fled the country, you were a child, but you were probably old enough to remember. I would imagine it was kind of a terrifying experience for a child to have to leave everything behind.
It was. And I knew from like around the age of 5 that something was going to happen. Something was going to go down in Saigon. And my father had planned an escape by boat. And when the government of Saigon, of South Vietnam, forbade the any non-governmental boats from leaving the harbor, my dad had to totally abandon that that plan and figure out some other way. And finally, we were able to go out on what I consider the business class ticket, which was on a plane a week before of Saigon. And we had two like bags with us, you know, imagine the size of like backpacks for a family of 7. And it was really scary. I remember bombs going off at one time. You know, my family did not have to suffer a lot of what my friends have suffered in becoming boat people, fleeing the country. But imagine, like, you know, I'm in my late 40s. Imagine, like, my father was 45 and my mom was 42, coming to a new country, not knowing how things work with 5 kids to raise. And that was frightening for them, but they also saw opportunities. And I think that when we came here, one of the opportunities really was food. Because on the one hand, we were here to preserve our heritage, so we would try to make things like pho and banh mi and also support the Little Saigon communities and our Vietnamese-American friends and their businesses. But we also, like, in Vietnam, butter, white sugar, flour, chocolate were, like, so expensive and exotic. And all of a sudden, we were, like, thumbing through Better Homes and Gardens and, like, trying to figure out, like, what's spaghetti? What's chili? What's a burrito? And we would, like, make those foods at home. But my mom would always have to have a pot of rice.
Mm-hmm. Where did you settle?
We were in Southern California in a small town called San Clemente, which is a beach town. It is a town that's closest to Camp Pendleton, which is a Marine base. And that's one of the first places that Americans settled, refugees coming from Vietnam. So we were considered like the first wave. And my dad was so eager to get out of the refugee resettlement facilities that he said, okay, here's this town of San Clemente. And Richard Nixon was living there. He retired to San Clemente. And my dad said, if it's good enough for an American president, it's good enough for me.
Your dad sounds amazing. It also seems incredible that your entire family was able to leave together, because I've heard so many stories about families separated and coming at different times, and that must have been a source of strength as a child, that It was your entire family that made it over there.
It was, you know, and it wasn't until maybe 6 or 7 years ago when I was asking my dad a little bit more about that time we were leaving. And I memories are funny because we kind of circle back and we expand them over time. So the first time I asked my dad about how we left was when I wrote a children's book many, many years ago about our country leaving, and it was for a bilingual education series. And then the second time I did it was for Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, my first cookbook, and that was, you know, that came out in 2006. And then we were circling back about something else, and then my dad said, you know, your aunt offered to take your two oldest sisters out, and then she said, when we came, we could be reunited with them. And my dad said, no, I want the entire family to go. I do not want to give up two of my children because they need to be near me. And so, you know, it was that thing of like, it's all of us or none of us.
So what was it like being a child in California? You were poking meat in supermarkets. What else?
I'm poking
what else
meats
were you
in
doing?
Supermarket. Okay. And going to public school, and I was on the free lunch program because we did not have that much money. But I also like ended up packing my own lunches, and I would like make strange bun me sandwiches with like liverwurst. I know it sounds strange, but liverwurst on white bread.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
Right? And no one knew I was making that sort of lunch for myself.
My dad was making me liverwurst sandwiches, but I have a hunch yours in the 70s were much better than mine the 70s.
That's why we both share a love of Vietnamese food. And then on the weekends, my mom would make pho because we, you know, she would brew it on Saturday. And then on Sundays, we would rush home from church and we would go to like 8 o'clock mass and our stomach would be like churning, you know, and all you'd have was that darn wafer. And we'd run home and we'd form a pho assembly line. And so my pho experiences oftentimes were at home on the weekends for brunch. And that was very defining. And we had Vietnamese food for dinner most of the time. And we would make things like my mom would make charcuterie from pork that she ground up in the food processor. And she would like send my brother out with a machete to cut down like a piece of banana leaf from like this tree that we had out in front. Because my parents are like, if we're going to buy a house in America, we got to have a banana tree because every Vietnamese home that's self-respecting has to have a banana tree. So they would send him out there to do that. And, you know, there were like strange things happening like that. And a lot of my friends that I grew up with had no idea this was going on in our house. And sometimes my mom would like be like charring pieces of pork leg in the fireplace and doing really, really weird things that now that you would consider her to be like this, you know, Wonder Woman cook. But back
and totally hip.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. She'd be like a total superstar now. But back then it was really alien. And I felt like I was always kind of like on the margins. So a lot of my work has been to bring Asian food traditions and flavors and concepts, moving them from the margin into the mainstream.
So your first book, Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, was pretty groundbreaking because I still to this day do not understand why, but Vietnamese food should be so much more popular in America than it is. Why? I mean, I have my own theories, but I want to hear what you think.
You know, it's very accessible in the sense that it's this amalgam of East and West. So you've got your sandwiches. And, you know, who doesn't love a sandwich? And you can customize that sandwich with whatever you want. If you're a vegan, no problem. If you like offal, no problem. And then there's pho, clear broth, noodles. Again, customizable food. But it's
gluten-free.
And gluten-free and healthy. You know, you can have it with no fat if you want. Oh, but how boring. But the thing is that it's beguiling. At the same time, it is difficult to figure out how those flavors come together. And I also think that for a lot of Americans, Asian ingredients remain a mystery. Even if you shop at a grocery store, you go into the Asian food section, it's like, what are those things? Different languages and Asia is not monolithic. It's really like huge with all these different cultures. And so trying to parse what's what and what to use is very challenging. So I think that has in part been one of the reasons why Vietnamese food has not been so popular. Also, fish sauce. the word sounds awful. I mean, bad translation. We need like the French or the Japanese to come up with like a better term
for that.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wonder how much of it is leftover baggage from the war that Vietnamese food just didn't take off. And also, people don't realize this, but Vietnamese food never really took off in New York City. The Vietnamese really didn't settle in New York City, and so much of the food media is here. So I wonder if part of it has to do with that it just wasn't in the backyard of all these food writers.
Yeah, no, definitely. It wasn't in the backyard of food writers, so Vietnamese people settled where it's warm. I mean, you know, closest thing is D.C. and Maryland, Virginia. And then in the South and in on the West Coast. And for the most part, the Vietnamese just opened up restaurants and markets for their own community. They did not do crossover projects. So that's another reason. So it's like if you wanted Vietnamese food, you had to go look for it. It wasn't coming at you. It's only very recently that people have been doing crossover restaurants. That means, you know, Vietnamese people opening up restaurants that are in non-Vietnamese neighborhoods. And also pho being popular enough so that there are instant pho kits at Whole Foods, for example.
Oh, I've seen those. That must crack you up.
It does.
I remember the first time I saw that.
Yeah, and even like, you know, in regular supermarkets, there's like this instant pho in the styrofoam bowl that you can get at a regular market that comes from Vietnam. So that's all really new. And I think that really reflects millennials being interested in bigger flavors, not being afraid of different foreign languages, for example, like mispronouncing pho. I mean, you know, people...
Oh, wait, yeah, I meant to ask you that. That was going to be the first question I asked you because I know that bedevils a lot of people. How do you pronounce it?
But you did it so beautiful, Carrie, so I just kind of like, hey, let's just go into the conversation. Well, this is a thing because pho can be spelled just as pho, so that's like pho. But once that you have all the accent marks in there, it gets a little bit challenging too, right? So once that you have that little side hook, then that's, without the side hook, it's pho. With the side hook, it's pho. With the little question mark, it's pho. So if you always like, you know, do that upward intonation bit, that little lilt at the end, pho, then you're going to like totally impress, you know, a Vietnamese speaker. Go in there. If you're on a date or something, you want to show off, say pho. Do you want to go to have pho?
I trip up on it. I mean, I've been to Vietnam a few times now, and I try my best. I will leave it at that. Since your new book is the Pho Cookbook, let's talk all about this wonderful soup and how you've broken it down in the book. And I'm guessing there might be a listener or two who isn't familiar with the soup. So can you walk us through the basics?
Sure. Pho is basically the national food of Vietnam. And you're talking about clear broth, flat rice noodles. So think of like linguine or fettuccine size white rice noodles floating in fragrant broth that's oftentimes spiced with things like star anise and cinnamon and fennel and coriander, ginger, and some onion in there. And there's protein, so you can call your protein. Chicken and beef are very popular, but there's also, you can have tofu in there because we do have Buddhists and non-meat eaters in Vietnam. And then, you know, it's garnished with cilantro and green onion and a lot of times sliced yellow onion or red onion. And then you can doll it up with herbs and lime and bean sprouts. And you can also have sriracha and hoisin sauce with it. I like it on the side, but some people love to just squirt those sauces into their bowls.
And I read that your mom is viciously opposed to sriracha in pho.
She's like, that is a Thai ingredient. And to her, it's the equivalent of putting ketchup into chicken noodle soup. She's like, it totally obliterates the soup. And so we often have just raw chili slices, and it's a different kind of heat. It's really bright. We also have mint with our pho.
I loved your idea of just picking up the chili slice with your chopsticks and swirling it, not dumping it in there, but just swirling it for like a little bit of heat. I'm going to do that next time.
Yeah, because otherwise you're going to pay.
Exactly. I've made my pho way too spicy, and I'm like, oh, why? I kind of ruined it. but now I know. I'm just going to do a little swirl. We are going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more from Andrea, and she's going to tell us about her cookbook and the pho-inspired dishes that go way beyond soup. We'll be right back. Cheese lovers take note. Kerrygold, the Irish brand known for its excellent butter, is a great source for amazing cheese. Kerrygold makes everything from a special reserve cheddar that's been aged over 2 years to a blue farmhouse cheese, which is semi-soft and creamy with a signature tang. Whether you are making a killer grilled cheese sandwich for yourself, baking some cheddar and scallion scones for breakfast, or putting together a beautiful platter of cheese, crackers, fruits, and nuts for your guest, try one of Kerrygold's luscious options. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. So, Andrea, we were talking about, even though it's called the Pho Cookbook, it goes way beyond soup. Tell us some of the other fun things that are in the cookbook that people can make.
Well, one of the things is that, in all honesty, and I'm very upfront about this in the book, I didn't really think I could write a pho cookbook. I was like, I got my recipes, I got the chicken one, I got the beef one, I have nothing else left to say. But my publisher and also people that I knew online, my Facebook people and people have taken cooking classes with me, have said, you know what, you have a lot to say. And my publisher and my editor said, go ahead and go home and think about it. Go and hibernate, you know, and marinate on this thing. Simmer on it. So I came back and to them after I'd done a fair amount of research and realized that the meaning of the word pho is twofold. It means the noodle soup that we're all familiar with. It also has to deal with the actual noodle itself, the flat rice noodles, because the word pho is actually related to the Chinese term for flat rice noodle. So if people are familiar with chow fun, so the pho is like this Vietnamese pidgin form of fun. And you can see it, I traced it back to like old woodblock prints from like 1908 in Hanoi, where pho got its started, where it got its start. And the woodblock prints were of these Chinese of Chinese pho vendors, and in Chinese it said like beef noodle vendor, and the noodle part was, it had nothing about the French word for pho, which a lot of people think that it means, because the two terms sound the same, that it's like pot au pho and here's Vietnamese pho, the French were in power at that time. No, it really is like has this Chinese root, and it has that dual meaning. The other thing I thought about pho is that it's an experience. So what do we love about pho? We love the spice notes. So in the book, there's this cool spice blend that I came up with. And we love the broth. So I use the broth in many different ways to make rice. For example, there's a chicken pho fat rice. So then you're going to use leftover poached chicken from a batch of chicken pho, and then you use the broth to make the rice, and then you harvest that fat. Because Vietnamese food at the end of the line is one that's extremely resourceful, and we, you know, repurpose a lot of things. So then it's sort of like Hainan chicken and rice, but this is made with stuff that you made from pho, and you would eat it with herbs. There's also pan-fried, stir-fried, deep-fried pho noodles, because, you know, when you go and you look at a Vietnamese menu, it may have pho noodle soup, and then all of a sudden you turn, and there's a whole section on what they call, like, stir-fried pho. But that's not the noodle soup. That's just the stir-fried noodles. And they're very wide, sort of like pappardelle with noodles. So that's a whole other thing. And then when I was in Vietnam, I discovered pho cocktails.
Pho cocktails? What part? Were you in Hanoi?
I was in Hanoi.
Hanoi has such an interesting cocktail culture right now.
It really does. And I was completely incredulous. And my friends, they were like, oh, well, you know, if you really want to see what we're doing with pho, you got to go and look at the pho cocktail. I paid like $24 to add.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money,
even,
right?
Even in Brooklyn, that's a lot of money for a cocktail.
It is.
Andrea.
I know. And there was a whole, it was like performance art. And they like pour gin through these like, three sets of cups that had holes in the bottom of them. And each one of these cups had whole spices like star anise and black pepper and cinnamon. And then they lit the gin on fire. So it went multiple rounds. And at the end, they added some Cointreau, served it over ice with chili slices and cilantro and mint. And it worked. So then I was like, all right, I'm going to go home. And I came up with some pho cocktails in the book. So what the book does is it tells a story of pho and what pho can be and what pho means to Vietnamese people. And also that pho is a very democratic food, that anybody can come in and be part of that pho story and make pho. Because I don't ever think that just because you're Vietnamese, you know how to make a Vietnamese food or you do it well. I think that anybody can make this food.
I'm happy to hear that. You really demystify it. I mean, we talked about this earlier. I happened to be involved in a Vietnamese-influenced restaurant in Carroll Gardens, Nightingale 9. But I'm scared to make pho. I love to make chicken soup. I'll make bone broth. But there's something about pho that scares me. And I think maybe it's exactly what you said. You know, sometimes you think if you're not part of that culture, you know, it's not there for you. But it is. It absolutely is.
It is, you know, and I've had people over the years who are not as engaged in food media as we are. They're not living, you know, drinking, thinking about it all the time. And I remember this man years ago emailing me, and he said, I made pho. And he was a white guy. And he said, and I wanted to test your recipe. So I took it to a nearby Vietnamese-owned nail salon and had the ladies try it. And he said, and they asked me if your work is available in Vietnamese.
My first question is, why do you answer all your emails?
Well, because
sometimes you get those strange ones, and you're like, maybe I shouldn't engage.
Right. But, you know, there are people who have all these, like, unusual, beautiful stories that they want to share with you. And once in a while, they're real, you know, they're keepers, like that one.
I would imagine you get a lot like that, but because you really put yourself out there, you do cooking classes, you have that wonderful website. And the first thing I thought when I looked at your website, I was like, how do I get to sign up for a cooking class with Andrea? So why don't you tell us? Because you're making the rounds right now. You're cooking, you're doing book signings.
I am. And I mostly teach cooking classes in the Bay Area, in Santa Cruz, where I live. And I do hands-on classes because, you know what? I'm not one to, like, why do you want to just come to some place and, like, pour and stir, right? So people come to my classes and they get to play with the ingredients and we, you know, put together things. We make mistakes. We correct ourselves. And it's a very empowering thing. And I do it nearby my home because it's easier, and then I get to do all the grocery shopping, which I love to do, and it's a very personal experience. Once in a while, I'll teach classes, in New York. I've taught at ICE for a long time. I also teach online at a site called craftsy.com, and those are these video classes that are really well produced, and I'm always engaged in answering, people's questions on Craftsy. And then with something like Craftsy, you can you own the classes forever, and you can just watch me and what I call Mr. Hands, like form dumplings or like roll rice paper rolls or something like that. And so, you know, I hope to do more stuff, but I'll be doing some video programs and Facebook Lives.
Oh, fun. On your personal Facebook account?
Well, you know, I'm right now, it's hard to do that alone, okay? So I have a date with Food 52 on Monday.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. And your personal site is called vietworldkitchen.com.
Correct.
Yes. And then you will be at the Food Book Fair this weekend. What are you doing at the Food Book Fair?
Well, it'll be Mother's Day, so come on by to talk about, you know, pho with me. I'll be, but also, at 1 o'clock, I'm on a really interesting panel about diversity in food media. And that's with some of my colleagues from and friends from Food 52. And then that's at 1 p.m. at the Ace Hotel. And then at 2:30, I'm going to be doing a book signing for the pho book. So come on by and have me sign your book. Kitchen Arts and Letters is going to be selling the book. And I also brought a bunch of pho heart pins. So, you know, gift with purchase, everyone. So come on by.
We swapped pho pins for bomb squad pins because Andrea, whether she knows it or not, has been a member of the bomb squad for a long time because we're such big fans. I saw you're also doing a cooking class at Milk Street on May 18th. So if you're in the Boston area, absolutely check that out. Speaking of signed books, we are giving away a signed copy of the Pho Cookbook. you just need to go to our Instagram account at Cherry Bomb Mag and leave a comment. We're asking people what their favorite comfort food is, since yours is pho. So leave a comment. We'll pick somebody at random to win a signed copy of this wonderful cookbook. Before I let you go, I want to talk about Vietnam, because it is one of my favorite places on the planet. If I could visit Vietnam all the time, I would. It's not quite in my backyard, but it is absolutely worth the journey. I think if you love food and you love culture and history and everything, you have to put a visit to Vietnam on your bucket list. And how often do you go back?
I try to go back as many times, you know, as often as possible, maybe every other year or something like that. It's a gentle country. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, people were afraid of going to Vietnam, and they would ask me for tour recommendations or ask if I gave tours. I'm like, no, I can't keep people happy 24/7. That's just not my personality. The other thing.
Noted,
please, everyone. The other thing, too, is that Vietnamese people are really great at, like, reading your needs. And sometimes, you know, needs don't quite fully match, but things all do work out. Because then someone will go into crisis mode and get you what you need. And it happens to me, you know, because they look at me and think that I am a foreigner because I don't look Vietnamese. I'm bigger. My hair is different. I speak Vietnamese awkwardly to them. And so every single time I go back, it's an adventure. And whether, you know, you can go and speak English and it's great. When I'm in Vietnam, I hear Viet expats who are younger speaking English. They are not really fluent in Vietnamese, but they're going. And so what I'm saying is that you do not need to know Vietnamese to go. Some Vietnamese, like especially food words, will make you extremely charming and will get you far in terms of making food friends. But, you know, I wholly encourage people to go and experience Vietnam. And I have never gotten ill from food poisoning in Vietnam, only from overeating.
Me neither. And I've eaten street food, restaurant food, you name it. And never gotten sick. And the people are so lovely, and the food is so good. It's by far the best food I've ever had in my whole life. Where would you recommend that people go?
I would suggest, you know, hitting the three regions. You can do it in probably a week and a half, you know. A start in Saigon if you're urban, and then work your way up north. So I would go Saigon, Hoi An, Hue, and then Hanoi. Hanoi is it's bucolic and it's really beautiful, but I feel like sometimes when you're dropped into Hanoi, it can be a little bit glaring. The first time
that's kind of funny. When I first went, I dropped into Hanoi.
I did too, and it was 2003, and it was like people were still building the road from the airport into town and using wheelbarrows.
The scariest part was crossing the street with all the mopeds. Oh my gosh, you've never seen anything like traffic in Hanoi with just thousands of mopeds and motorbikes and trying to cross, and you're like, okay, I'm just going to do it, and you come up with your own little system.
Yeah. Holding hands is good. Finding an older woman to go with you is really great.
I advise don't make eye contact. Just do it. Don't make eye contact with the drivers. They see you. They really don't go that fast, which you'll realize. I loved Hoi An. I loved visiting Hoi An and Da Lat and the sort of beachy areas. The beaches were beautiful. I saw the most beautiful sunset of my life there one night. It was just this pink sunset, and it just took over everything. Everything was bathed in pink light. The water was pink. The sand was pink. The sky was pink. It was really magical.
Yeah. Hoi An is beautiful. Hoi An is easy and picturesque. You don't, you know, there's a lot of like urban funk and dirt and grit in Vietnam. And there you see a lot of trash. You also see people who are sometimes very, very poor, and it'll break your heart at times. But, you know, exposure to that is really important because Vietnam is a developing country. It's a communist country. And so people don't have certain freedoms that we assume
I don't know if the listeners can hear that, but it sounds like there is like a horror movie or a rock concert taking place next to us. Hopefully you're not hearing that.
I think they're screening Evil Dead later.
Oh, they're screening Evil Dead later yeah. at the pizza place that we're connected to. Okay, well, that's what we're hearing.
Well, you know,
sorry
what?
About that.
I'm just saying, you know, don't, you're not sheltered.
Absolutely.
Or take shelter.
Well, Andrea, I'm so sorry we have to end our interview. Please come back anytime. Like I said, we're huge fans. Go see, check out Andrea's website. Go visit her wherever she happens to be in this country. You'll love learning from her. You will love her new cookbook, The Pho Cookbook. One more thing that you wrote, I can't remember whether it was in the cookbook or on your website. You said, at the end of the day, my aim is to, one, capture the human connections to food, and two, demystify Asian food without dumbing it down. There's no reason why more people shouldn't include good Asian cooking into their rotation. That's absolutely true. So thank you so much for your time. We'll see you this weekend, and we'll be right back with Kendra Aronson after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle de Stael. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've ever dreamed of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to start living that dream. Check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world, or add a short vacation or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, online registration, and to discover which school is best for you. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu. Our next guest is Kendra Aronson, the food writer, photographer, and self-publisher of the San Luis Obispo, did I say that right?
Obispo
Farmer's Market Cookbook, simple seasonal recipes and short stories from the central coast of California. After a successful Kickstarter campaign in which she raised $27,000, Kendra caught the attention of major bookstores and even farm-to-table goddess Alice Waters. Kendra also runs her own creative studio and founded the Central Coast Creatives Club. Kendra, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you, Carrie. It's so exciting to be here.
It's been a long time coming.
Yes, it has.
You have been such a hustler with this cookbook. You brought it to our attention years ago. Mm-hmm. I think we met you at one of our events in San Francisco, right?
Yeah,
it's
at Omnivore Books.
At Omnivore Books.
Celia's Bookshop.
We mm-hmm. all love that place. And you have just done an incredible job spreading the word about
farmers markets
and this cookbook and your amazing work. So why don't you tell us how the cookbook came about?
Yeah, so I originally had the idea in 2010 when I was in grad school in San Francisco, and I came across a book called the San Francisco Ferry Building Farmers Market Cookbook, and I just loved it. It was a smaller format book. You were made to take it with you to the farmers market there. It had a produce buying guide and profiles of farmers and very simple recipes. And while I was there, I thought, this book needs to exist for San Luis Obispo. They have an amazing farmers market scene down there. I had lived there for 4 years during college, so I had a tie to it. And from there, I just could not shake the idea out of my head. And also in 2010 was when Kickstarter was gaining traction as a platform. And so I knew that if I were going to tackle this cookbook and do it on my own, I would absolutely use Kickstarter and self-publish the book that way through a pre-order campaign. And yeah, just for years, I had the idea in my head. I thought about it constantly. When I started, I had absolutely zero experience in anything that I was doing. I was not a food writer. I was not a food photographer. I didn't even own an Adobe suite program. I didn't even know how to import a photo into Photoshop. That's how little I knew. And I was just so jazzed about the idea, and I knew that I could teach myself all these skills, and I knew that, you know, I'm not inventing the concept of a book. Books have been done before, and I can just research everything, and I can buy a camera, and I can teach myself, and I can go on Skillshare and Lynda and teach myself all these skills. So I basically just did that over a few years.
Tell people what Skillshare and Lynda are in case they don't know.
So Skillshare is incredible. They have tons of classes, and they're all geared towards creatives. So you can learn, you know, Photoshop 101 or hand illustration, watercoloring. I took a class with Chip Kidd, who is a well-known book cover designer in New York, and he taught book design 101, which was fantastic. I highly recommend it. It was my favorite class on Skillshare. And he just went through all the, you know, all the necessary elements that a cover needs and why certain covers stand off the shelf, and, you know, considerations for typeface and editorial layout and all of that. And yeah, so that's Skillshare. And then Lynda is more geared towards, it's more business and a little bit more techie. So if you need to learn how to code websites or make an Excel spreadsheet, things like that. And they're both great resources.
I love your approach to learning. You're like, well, there are millions of books.
Yeah.
It can't be that. Can't be that hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard.
It's definitely hard.
It can't be that mysterious.
Right. Yeah. Like, people have done this before. So if someone can do it, anyone can do it is kind of my mantra. And so I want to do it. So I'll teach myself.
What were you studying in school?
Undergrad, when I was living in San Luis Obispo, I studied Spanish, French, and Italian. And then in grad school, I studied TESOL, teaching English to speakers of other languages. So teaching English to non-native English speakers.
And tell me what was so magical about the farmers market that you couldn't get it out of your brain, the idea to do this cookbook.
Yeah. So in San Luis Obispo, we're known for our Thursday night market. They shut down the main street, and there are 140 vendors. About half of them are farmers, half of them are prepared foods and barbecue. And it's iconic. It's like, it's always in those top 10 guides of top 10 farmers markets in the nation that you must visit. And it's just great. It's a way that the whole town comes out every single Thursday, and there's entertainment and there's produce and there's food, and it's just really lovely. Everyone who has ever visited San Luis Obispo or lived there, they're very fond of it. So I wanted to create a book that really celebrated that. And we actually have 20 weekly farmers markets in our county, but the Thursday one is the one that we're really known for.
And were you always a farmers market junkie?
Yeah. When I moved to San Luis Obispo for college, that's when I fell in love with farmers markets, because it was, you know, every week I could walk to it, and I remember distinctly eating a strawberry and thinking, what have I been eating my whole life? It hasn't been this. This is so juicy. It's basically running down my elbow. It's the like quintessential strawberry. And then I would get them every single week. And then with all the other produce that was available, I would just fall in love with it. And that was also very eye-opening, just learning about seasonality, because when you go to a grocery store, you can buy anything more or less year round. And so it made me think more about the food that I was eating and the people that I was buying it from and supporting. And I just immediately fell in love with it.
It's incredible when you get to eat seasonal produce for the first time. Mm-hmm. You're just ruined forever.
Yeah.
Because it's just not the same. You know, that magical peach, like mm-hmm. you said, that magical strawberry.
Yes.
I love California's farmers markets.
Yes, so lucky.
Anytime I'm out there, even if it's a business trip, mm-hmm. if I can figure out a way to get to a farmers market, I'm just so happy.
Yes.
They're wonderful here in New York, too. But, you know, the seasons are a little different here in New York, and
right.
we just don't have the same abundance of things that you have out there. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you approach your farmers market shopping. Do mm-hmm. you go and just wait to be inspired as you walk around all the different stands, or mm-hmm. do you go with a plan?
A little bit of both. So I own a ton of cookbooks, and I love cooking out of them. And so oftentimes I'll have certain recipes that I'm making for the week. So I'll write all those ingredients down, and I'm going into the market with that plan to buy those ingredients. But then I'm always open to being inspired or seeing what is actually available on the table. Sometimes I go in with an idea, but oh, it rained a lot this past week and they don't have anything that they can harvest that fits my grocery list. Or, oh, wow, I've never heard of this vegetable. I'm going to ask the farmer how I should prepare it. And they always have great tips. So, yeah, a little bit of both plan, but then open to inspiration.
And tell us a few of your absolute favorite fruits and vegetables. What just makes your heart sing when you see it at the farmer's market?
Yeah, well, right now, since we're in spring, a lot of berries are coming back into season, like blueberries and strawberries are like hitting their stride right now. And I love anything that is green in the spring. So especially peas. I love English peas, snap peas, sugar peas, asparagus, doing all those things and like squeezing lemon on it. Just anything that's bright and green and yeah, fragrant, lots of herbs, a lot of things.
Do you have a favorite recipe in your cookbook?
Oh, man, so many.
I know that's like asking, you know, what's your favorite friend or favorite child or whatnot, but pick one that is really special to you.
Yeah, really special. So the one that I was just thinking about actually was a salad where it does have all those peas and then plus arugula and plus mint and a very simple lemon vinaigrette. So that to me, and then it has a huge ball of burrata on top, so it's delicious. But yeah, there's
a giant ball of burrata makes everything in life better.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, there's just so many recipes in here. It just really depends on the mood that I'm in, the season that it is, the type of meal that I'm making, whether it's a baked good or lunch or dinner. There's just so many to choose from.
Was it hard getting the recipes from people?
You know, that was something that scared me at first because they are contributed recipes by local farmers and local chefs within Slo County. And I remember I procrastinated on asking people because I was so scared that they were going to say no, especially the chefs. I kind of had this idea that they would keep their recipes very guarded and they wouldn't want them published. But I would say 95% of the people that I reached out to, they were just 100% on board. They were so excited about the idea of the project and the collaboration. And so it worked out that they were very open to it and wanted to be a part of it. So, and that was so surprising. I remember I kept procrastinating on asking. And then I had that light bulb moment of, okay, if everyone says no, then I'll just take more time and develop recipes and make it myself. Like I'm just back to where I am now, which is I have zero recipes. So it's not the end of the world. Like I'll figure it out just like everything else.
Oh, you were really committed to making that book happen.
Yes, absolutely.
So how can people find the book?
Yeah, you can go to Slo, that's S-L-O, farmersmarketcookbook.com. And I also have it available at barnesandnoble.com and in all the California locations of Barnes & Noble. And yes.
Do you have another book in the works?
I do.
Ooh,
yeah.
Tell us.
I actually can't tell you what the content is because I'm not telling anyone yet. But that's actually one of the reasons why I'm here this week at Food Book Fair. I'm participating in the literary speed dating, or LSD as they're calling it. And I'm going to meet with publishers and editors and kind of swap it back on them. Instead of pitching, I want them to convince me why I should go through a publishing house. I've clearly self-published before, and I did very well for myself with this, so I know that I am capable of self-publishing again, but I am kind of curious what it would look like going through a traditional publishing house and what they can offer. So I'm here this weekend hoping that I can just ask people and really wrap my head around what I'm going to do with it and, how I'll approach it. But this one took me 2.5 years. I'm sure the next one will take 2.5, 3 years. And it's definitely going to be big. It has national appeal rather than this one is a little bit more regional or California-wide. And yeah, this one could essentially be a book that's sold, you know, where all books are sold type thing. So,
but you're one of the official participants in the literary speed dating, right? Mm-hmm. So if people have questions for you about how to self-publish, all of that, they can stop by and ask you?
No, I bought a ticket so that I could talk to the people.
Got it. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, maybe people will recognize you and they can stop you and ask you, because I think your knowledge is as valuable as some of those other folks.
Oh, yeah. And I'm very, very open. If anyone wants to get in touch with me about, if they have any questions whatsoever about self-publishing a cookbook, you can reach me at KendraAronson.com is my website. And, I love sharing about how all the nuts and bolts of how I actually did it, or asking or answering very specific questions that fellow authors have, because it is, I mean, you know, right? Because you self-published Cherry Bomb, so it's a whole beast. And things that, if you're new to the print world or the publishing world, there's so much that you learn along the way. And I've actually taught some self-publishing workshops in San Luis Obispo, and I've been asked recently if I'm going to ever offer it online. So I'm kind of thinking about that as well, just because people have been asking, and I love sharing. I want to see other people do it as well, because it is possible.
And it is so great if you feel that you just don't have connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know a lot of people have great ideas for cookbooks, but mm-hmm. they don't know publishers. They don't have an agent.
Right.
And I think that's the beauty of today's world.
Yes.
You know, if you have a great idea, mm-hmm. there are lots of ways to get it out into the universe these days. And you shouldn't let mm-hmm. lack of connections, mm-hmm. lack of money, like in your case, you did a Kickstarter.
Right.
You know, those things don't have to stop you anymore.
Right. Yeah. I knew that when I started this book that I had all the odds stacked against me. I had never been formally published in any magazine. I owned a camera, but had never really read the camera manual fully. Didn't own Adobe programs. I really didn't know anything about self-publishing. I had never ran like a marketing campaign. Definitely had never run my own Kickstarter campaign. So just, yeah, if you're really curious about learning and eager to learn and put yourself out there, then, you know, people will recognize that. And, if it's really easy to make excuses, but you just got to make it happen. You just got to, I don't know. Yeah.
So eat pho and just do it. That's the moral yes. of today's show. We are giving away a copy of Kendra's book as well. Mm-hmm. We'll put a post on our Instagram account in a little while, and we'll figure out a question for you to answer, and you can win a signed copy of her book. But also check out her website. If you don't win the book, go buy a copy of it, because it's really wonderful. And Kendra, thank you. Like I said, you've been in touch for a long time,
yes.
and we're really happy to see how well you've done with this book, and how, with, you know, some hustle and a great idea, you can make something fun happen.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a crazy journey. It's so exciting.
So that's it for today's show, everybody. Radio Cherry Bomb was engineered by the one and only Dave Tatasciore. Thank you to our sponsors for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Kerrygold cheese is made in Ireland with milk from grass-fed cows, and it's a taste that says 1,000 words, including, it's the bomb. Visit cordonbleu.edu to learn about the variety of culinary classes offered at the legendary Le Cordon Bleu's many locations around the world. As we mentioned, don't forget to check out our Instagram giveaways. Our handle is at Cherry Bomb Mag. Don't forget the E in Cherry Bomb. You can follow me, too, at Cherry Bomb. I'm always happy for feedback about the show and suggestions for future guests. If you come to the Food Book Fair this weekend, please come say hi to the Cherry Bomb team. We'll be there Saturday and Sunday at the Foodioticals Market. Mm-hmm. Look for Kendra.
Yes.
And that's it, everybody. Thank you for listening. You're the bomb.
I'm Jill Strominger, and I'm a messy baker and freelance food and culture writer living in Brooklyn. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Rupa Kalyanaraman Marcello. Her new company, Monsoon Sweets, features cakes and cookies that showcase the beautiful flavors of South Asia she grew up with, such as cardamom, ginger, coconut, and green curry. Ruba will be sharing her monsoon sweets at NYC's Hester Street Fair on select Saturdays starting this weekend. Stop by to say hello after you visit the Food Book Fair.